I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Jerry MC from Chula Vista.
MC in the
house.
My name's Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic, among other things. A lot of people always say I'm an alcoholic and an addict, and to me that sounds like I'm saying I'm short and I'm not very tall. Because to me, addiction is addiction, and I've been addicted to just about anything you can name. I was a glutton. I mean, anything I'd get my hands on, anything that would get me and change my reality, I was a fan of. I started off sniffing glue, then I got into drinking, then I got into pot and acid and heroin, cocaine. There's some new stuff that's come along the pike, you know, the oxy stuff and all that, that I haven't had a chance to try yet. But judging from my reaction to all the other shit, I know that I don't need to try it because I know what the result is going to be. I brought a little prop here tonight when I went to my first rehab. I was with this is up in Santa Rosa. I went to a place called the Arenda Center, and I was done. I was more than done, but I just couldn't stop. I'd been to meetings. I tried anabuse. I tried hypnotherapy. I tried a lot of stuff, and I just could not quit drinking. So I checked myself into a place called the Arenda Center in Santa Rosa, which I'd heard about all the way down here. It had a sliding pay scale. If you didn't have any money, they'd take you in anyway. It was a nice facility. They had three hots and a cot. And I needed to be there, and I knew I needed to be there. And the first day I came in, I was sitting there in the intake part with my counselor, the guy who was signing all the paperwork and whatever, and they'd taken my clothes. I'm sitting there in paper pajamas and paper shoes and a paper shirt, and we start negotiating. The guy, can you do one day at a time? And I said, no, you can't do 24 hours at a time, no. He goes, well, what can you do? And we started negotiating, and we got down to where I can do 10 minutes. And so he ran into the kitchen and brought out one of these. And he set it on 10 minutes. And he gave me a big book. He said, sit there, read the book, and when the thing rings, let me know. So I started reading the book, and after a while, ding, and it came out, and he said it again. And I just kept on reading. So that's how I kind of got a start on this thing. I'd also like to say this is my first time at this meeting, too. It looks like a really good group. I want to congratulate Nora and welcome all the newcomers. And we're all here for the newcomers. That's the way I see it. We're here for you. And the reason I'm here is I'm not all there. And after my story, you'll probably see what I mean. I grew up in Chula Vista. I moved there when I was very young, and I was an alcoholic long before I took the first drink. I don't know why, but I was wired that way. I used to, you know, some people blame their father, them, you know, whatever. My dad drank, but I only saw him drunk once in my youth. But I noticed one thing about my dad is that when he did drink, he changed from this really stern kind of almost angry guy into the life of the party. All of his friends would be rolling on the ground laughing at my dad. And it didn't take me long. I was like 5 or 6 years old. I went, that's what I want. I don't want to be like that guy. I want to be like this guy. And so I associated alcohol with having fun. So I started sneaking it here and there at Thanksgiving a little bit. Thanksgiving is a big day in my drinking career. So at Thanksgiving, when I was about 10, my dad started pouring a little bit of Loganberry, elderberry wine. And Loganberry, I think it was. Awful stuff. Tastes like cough syrup. But I'd instantly, as soon as they're out watching football, I'm back in the kitchen sneaking a little more. And I got that warm glow in my gut. And I said, well, I want more of this. And then the day after Thanksgiving in 1961, I was in ninth grade. My best friend and I decided we're going to get some booze and we're going to get drunk. And we bought a fifth of vodka from a kid down the street that worked at a grocery store. And we proceeded to get hammered. Unbeknownst to us, the guy who sold us the vodka had poured off about half of it and replaced it with rubbing alcohol. And if you've ever read the back of a rubbing alcohol bottle, it says, do not take internally. It causes extreme gastric distress, which meant cramps, diarrhea, projectile vomiting for a long time. And that's what my first experience really getting hammered was. Now, the next day, I'm crawling from the wreckage, and I feel absolutely horrible. So does my best friend. Now, I'm going, well, we must have done something wrong here, because I've seen other people drink and not have this outcome. My best friend's going, I ain't ever doing that again. But I had the alcoholic mind going, I got to figure out how to do this. So I started rehearsing, and I got good at it. I got to the point where I was a highly functioning alcoholic. To show you an example of that, I never had a DUI. How many people here have had DUIs? I never had one. I totaled 13 cars in my drinking career. I totaled 4 in one accident. And the cops, I was able to bullshit my way out of it. And they gave me my keys back, or they let me go. And, that was really great. I was talented, I thought. So to make matters even worse, I became a musician. And I'm not sure. In the beginning, I thought I became a musician because I liked music. No, I became a musician because it's the perfect cover for a drug addict alcoholic. I mean, you go to a party, you go to a concert, you go anywhere, you're the center of attention, and they want to get you high. And I took full advantage of that. I opened up in concert for a lot of really famous acts, legendary acts and whatever, but all I was there for was to get high, get laid, and have a great time, but mostly to get high and get drunk. And I got away with it. Once again, I was able to get away with it. The only reason I finally came to the conclusion that I really needed to drink, or needed to stop, I should say, is I went to the doctor and for a routine physical, and he goes, "You drink a lot." And I said, "Well, yeah, enough." And he goes, "Well, your liver is starting to give out on you. You have maybe a year or two before it's really going to become a problem." I already had alcoholic hepatitis, and he was saying that does turn into cirrhosis. And by that time, I was in my 20s, but I just kept on drinking for another 5 or 6 years. And I got to the point where I was so sick, every time I drank, I threw up. I mean, that was just automatic, the price of doing business. And I was okay with that. I learned how to do it very well. I could throw up in a room full of people, and they didn't even know I did it. I got very quiet and very professional at that. So then I finally moved up way out of my... I figured the problem was because I'm a musician, I'm growing up in San Diego, I need to get out of here. I need to do a geographic. So I moved up to San Francisco, into the Bay Area. Well, there's no drugs or alcohol up there. And I continued to drink, and I heard about the Surrender Center place, which I'd heard about down here. I actually went to my first AA meeting when I was in 10th grade. I'd gotten arrested for the third time. And my probation officer told me he was going to put me in Chino Reformatory as an incorrigible. And so I went to this meeting, and I was here. I'm like 13 years old or 14, and this meeting was, it was quite a lot different back then. Number one, everybody was really old, like they were over 40. There was hardly any men. It was all guys. And chain smokers, the smoke was down to about here. And I walked in there, this baby-faced 14-year-old kid, and they just laughed at me. "What are you doing here? You know, you can't be an alcoholic." So I sat through the meeting, and I got out of there, and I said to myself, "Well, I've got the opinion of experts. I can't be an alcoholic." So I went on, and I continued on my merry way. And along the road, I got into drugs. Drugs is part of my story. To not add the drug part, I believe only telling half the story. I was a garbage pail. My drug of choice is whatever you had or whatever I could get my hands on, and I mean anything. I was not discriminating. All of those things almost killed me. My motto was to find something that made me feel different or feel good and do it till it hurt. And I did that with just about everything you can name. Like I said, Oxy wasn't on the scene yet, but a lot of other... I used to go to TJ and walk into the boutiques down there, and I'd want 3 of the red ones, 5 of the yellow ones, and 6 of the black ones. And I just, and I would go on my merry way, and I would be toasted. That's when I had the accident where I hit the three parked cars and totaled those 3 and my own. Now, luckily enough, I said I never had a DUI. The cops showed up, and I was slobbering, falling down, under the influence. And back in those days, you either had to take a breath test, a urine test, or a blood test. So they gave me the field sobriety test. I failed. They took me to Chula Vista City Jail. And I was smart enough to say, "I want the breath test." And I passed because I had had no alcohol. So I go to court the next day to be arraigned. And back then, the law has been changed since then. But if you did not register, they couldn't get you for the 502 is what they called them back then. So they had to let me go on a technicality. Well, after they let me go, I became on a first name basis with every cop in that town. I was, "Hey, asshole," and, "Oh, yes, sir, officer." Because they knew what I had done. They couldn't prove it, and they had to let me go on a technicality. So I immediately said, "Well, time to leave town." So I moved to San Diego, proceeded to get in some trouble there, and then I had an opportunity to sign a recording contract and move to the Bay Area on the Russian River north of San Francisco, and got up there where nobody knew me. I didn't have a reputation. The cops didn't know me, and I went to work. In other words, you know what I mean. So that succeeded for a while. Then I moved to L.A. Big mistake. Because when you're in that situation, I never really did good drugs until I signed a recording contract. And all of a sudden, I've got people coming at me from every direction with great cocaine, great heroin, great this, great that, and they want to give it to me because they know I'm going to be a customer. A, they know I got money because I have this contract with all this front money they gave us. So I proceeded to take full advantage of that. And then I moved back down to San Diego because I was dying. I was dying in three-quarter time up there. I came back to San Diego, and I moved in with a dope dealer. He was a major dope dealer. I mean, he, big time, to the point where I was living right across the road from the Del Mar racetrack, and I'm laying there in bed one night, and all of a sudden I hear this sound coming. And underneath my floor in my room, I had about 100 pounds of pot, a couple of pounds of coke, and a couple hundred thousand dollars in cash. Because this guy was already a felon, and if he got busted one more time, he was going away. I had no felonies, so you get to hold on to the stash. So as the helicopter's coming in, it's the DEA. They come in with guns drawn, flak jackets on, but they asked me my name, and they had the wrong name on the warrant. So once again, they had to leave, and I got away with it. So that continued on. And then pretty soon, I get to this guy. He goes to prison for a while, and he gets out, and now he's a major cocaine dealer, bringing in a couple hundred pounds a week. And my job was to run the stash house. So all this cocaine is sitting in my closet. And the first thing he told me is, everything's itemized, everything's inventoried. You touch it, you die. Because we're talking about some major heavy hitters here. And then he comes in and proceeds to start breaking into the bags, doing all this stuff. And I realize, well, he's just lost control of the weight. He has no idea what he's taken, and I know that I can now open up these bags too and avail myself to all I want, and I'm still drinking. I had to drink so I could stay up. I had to take the coke so I wouldn't pass out, and I could drink for days, days and days. I'd stay for 5 and 6 days, and then finally I wouldn't pass out. I'd collapse, and I'd be out for maybe 2-3 days, and then I'd come to and start the process all over again. It got worse. Even after that, it got worse. He went away to jail again, and I figured I better get out of town again because the guys whose cocaine it was are now looking for me because he told them that I'd stolen a quantity of it. So I moved back up to Northern California to get away from the heat. Except everywhere I went, there I was. And I'm living back up there trying to get away from my life, trying to get away from me, but everywhere I went, there I was. And I started the whole deal all over again. And finally, I was close to dying. I went to the Arenda Center. I stayed once, got out, jumped back, went back, got out, went back. You said it took you 5 years to get 1 year. It took me 6 years to get 1 year of continuous sobriety. I started going to lots of meetings because I figured that was my only hope. But I got to the point where I had a handful of 30-day, 60-day, 90-day chips, to the point where they called me up and said, can you bring all those chips back? Because I don't want to have to go to the store and get more. So can we recycle your chips? So I took them all back, and I gave them, and I took them all over again. And then I figured, no, if I stay up here, I know I'm going to die. And I knew I was going to die. I was dying. And I don't want to die all the way up there. My family's down here. I figured it's time for me to go home. It's finally time for me to go back to the scene of the crime. And I heard about South Bay Pioneers while I was living up there. And I started going to the South Bay Pioneers. And I'd go to lots of meetings. I'd eat the food there. But I could not get past that 30, 60, 90-day hurdle because I always invariably went back to doing the same old stuff, different day. And if you are fairly new around here, I got to tell you, in the beginning, it's hard, but it does get easier. And while I'm on the topic of that, my sobriety date is July the 23rd, 1989. I'm 29 years clean and sober, and I would like to think that after 29 years, I've got a handle on this. You know what? I'm still the same guy. I'm sober now, but I'm still the same, insecure, neurotic. I have no patience. I have no tolerance. I have no understanding for others. Every report card I ever got said the same thing. I lack self-control, and I lack consideration for others, and that is the God's truth. I am that person. I'm sober, but I'm still that same person. So you may get sober, that's the start. But as you get into this, you've got to start peeling away at the layers. You've got to get into the steps. You've got to get a sponsor. You've got to do the 90 and 90 days. All those things are really important. And the reason I'm stressing this is because I'm 29 years clean and sober, and I'm going to less meetings than I've gone to in a very long time. I used to go to 5 and 6 meetings a week. I had a sponsor. My sponsor's here tonight. You know what? I am still battling the impatient, intolerant, lacking empathy for others. I'm quick to anger. Put a steering wheel in my hands, and I'm instant asshole. I don't know why. I mean, I know the right way to live, and I know the way I want to be, but the way I want to live and the way I want to be still eludes me. And I'm sober, but I'm not well. And that's one of the reasons I took this commitment to speak here tonight. Larry asked me about 3 months ago, and I had real misgivings about, should I do this? Should I do this? Because I'm up here kind of being a hypocrite. I'm presenting like, I got a long program, I got time, and all that kind of stuff. But you know what? I'm just as screwed up as a guy with 20 days. I'm just as screwed up as a guy with 29 days. Because I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, my name is Jerry. And I haven't changed that part. I am sober, and my life is better, but I got a long ways to go. So now, first 15 minutes, I was going to talk about what it was like. I mentioned to you about my friend that we got drunk together the first time. I proceeded to get him arrested 2 more times because I was always the guy that was instigating, let's go out and find some alcohol. And we'd go out and do that, and he was just willing to go along for the ride. And so we went to jail, we went to juvenile hall, and then coming back from Ducati in my pop's Cherry 54 Chevy pickup truck with the chrome stacks. I drove off the road because I was drunk as it could be and totaled the car and put my best friend in the hospital. He almost died. I almost killed him. And there's no feeling other than having killed somebody than watching your best friend laying in a hospital bed, really severely injured. And I was the cause. And I tore my license up. They were going to take it anyway, but I tore it up because I figured I can't do this anymore. But you know what? I did again and again and again and again. I got so good at it. I was amazing to myself. I got pulled over on several occasions and given field sobriety tests. I was in a total blackout. And the only reason I know that it happened is because one of my band members was in the car. And they were witness to it. And they said, you're unbelievable. The red lights go on and you pull yourself together and you go out there and talk clearly. Like, I was really good at it. And I almost wish now, in hindsight, that I would have gotten arrested and I would have gotten put in jail a few times. Because that might have, but no. Okay. That's what it was like. This is what happened. I started going to South Bay Pioneers. I was really into the deal down there. I went every opportunity I got. I had to walk at first because I had no license. I had no car. I had no job. I was unemployable. Okay, here's a good example of that. I had no keys. I had no keys. I had no house. I had no car. What do you need keys for? I have keys now. Wow. That's progress. That's this program at work. And I do work with others. I do sponsor some people. I do try to do service work when I can. And I think the reason I've kind of pulled back on going to as many meetings is because coming to this meeting, I don't know I don't think there's anybody out there that I know except for my wife and my sponsor. But it's nice to see some fresh blood and nice to be a part of new people that you go to the same meeting long enough and you've heard the same people say the same thing. And pretty soon you start getting, me anyway, I've been there, done that. I got the t-shirts, time to move on. And I can't afford that because I know I got one more drunk left in me. I don't think I got one more recovery in me. My sponsor and I just started talking. I'm going to go through the steps again. I haven't been through the steps in years. I've never had a sponsor that wanted to go through the steps with me. My sponsors were all really low-key. They didn't tell me what to do. They showed me what to do, and they led by example. And I was cool with that because I don't like being told what to do. I don't know about anybody else out there. You tell me what to do, and I will dig in my heels, and I'll start trying to do it my way again. I need leadership by example and not by direction. I don't know if that's correct, but it works for me. It doesn't work for everybody. I'm a survivor. I know that. I know I'm lucky, and I know I'm grateful. I had no idea what gratitude meant when I got here. I was absolutely ungrateful for all the time, even when I was a little kid before I started drinking. It was either not enough, not big enough, not new enough. I wanted 2 of them, no matter what it was. It was never enough. And I don't know why I'm that way. I was that way before long before I took the first drink. So here I am. in front of you tonight, and I'm trying to, hopefully, one of you newcomers will resonate with what I'm saying, because you don't have to do what I did. I hope you don't do what I did, because I took a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of damage, getting into my fourth step and my fifth step. Man, it was grim. It was like looking after the hurricane down in Florida or whatever. It was nothing but wreckage. And it took me the first 5-6 years, I think, before I really started making amends to people and really doing my financial amends. If I knew you, I screwed you. That was my MO. If you had something I want, I was your best friend. If you didn't have anything you want, I didn't know you, because that's the way I learned to operate in this world. Took me a long time to make all those amends, and I still have amends to make. There are some of those people I can't make amends to because they're gone. They're dead. There were 9 of us that grew up in my neighborhood, and I am one of 2 people left of those 9 guys. Everybody else either died in Vietnam from suicide, car wrecks, or drug overdoses. So I look back on my past, and I see just how lucky I am to be alive, because by all rights, I shouldn't be. I did enough stuff, enough heroin. I mean, I overdosed on just about everything you can name, and I survived. And I don't know why I was so lucky. I don't, unless, you know, there's somebody down there looking out for me. That's the only thing I can believe. Another thing I should mention is I'm an atheist. I've been an atheist since I was 10 years old. I was brought up a Catholic. Back then, the Mass was all in Latin, and I didn't understand it. It was all just gibberish to me. And then I had a chance to almost be an altar boy, but after church, after he'd asked me to be an altar boy, and I said no, my mom said yes, he saw me smoking. And he walked up to me and said, "No, altar boy, I might not be a cigarette smoker." And I went, "Great, works for me." And about 3 weeks later, he was gone. And the rumor started circulating. He was giving extra sacraments to the altar boys in the rectory, if you catch my drift. And to this day, I have to credit smoking for saving my ass. And since I moved back to Chula Vista, I have run into 2 guys and a woman that all suffered child abuse and from him. And I have no idea. They didn't arrest those guys back then. They just sent them on to the next block, the next unsuspecting church. And but it really soured me on the Catholic Church. There, ergo, it soured me on religion. It soured me on, I mean, it just was not my cup of tea. So when I first got sober, and, you know, as you know, they talk a lot about God around here, and that was just a turnoff to me. That was an absolute And I had a sponsor. My sponsor, the first sponsor was named Lou P. And I had to do my fifth step, and I started talking about people I needed to make amends to. And the first thing I said to him was, "Well, I probably need to make amends to the IRS because I didn't file income taxes for about 14 years. And I need to start there, I guess, if I'm going to." And he goes, "Well, speaking as a retired IRS agent, screw them." Okay. So he said, "You will file taxes this year, and you will file taxes every year after this year, but if they don't come looking for you, don't kick the dog." And I said, "Well, okay, I can live with that." But Lou had this thing when I kept telling him I have a problem with church, I have a problem with God, I don't want anything to do with that. He opened up the Bible to me and showed me a little sentence in there, 3 words, "God is love." And he looked at me and said, "Do you believe in love?" And I went, "Yeah, of course." And he goes, "Well, if you're coming from love, you're in a godly state. So all you have to do is know that God is love. If you can come from love on everything you're doing, it's really hard to be a drug addict, alcoholic, mean-spirited, rip-off artist, crazy man if you're coming from love. It doesn't come together. It doesn't fit." So that was a saving grace for me. I was able to get into coming from love. I am not religious, but I like to think I'm spiritual. I still have a long way to go, but I know that today, compared to what I used to be 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 29 years ago, I'm a heck of a lot better. My problems, I still have them, but the quality of my problems is certainly a lot better than they used to be. I don't live in fear anymore. I don't worry about people knocking on my door late at night. I don't worry about people calling me. I'm not hiding from anybody. And that is really set your soul free right there, because I was hiding from everybody. I mean, I had people, some seriously mean-spirited, violent, crazy Mexican drug cartel type people looking for me for about 3 years. And I don't worry about it anymore. I'm here and I'm okay. I'm sober. I'm clean. I'm sober. I'm here at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, hopefully sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. If one person takes away the message, then my deal here, it was successful. How are we doing? Oh, yeah, we got time. I may have to quit early so I can talk longer the next time I'm here. I haven't spoken to a group in a long time. I kind of laid off for that for about, it's been about 5 years. So I'm a little bit out of practice. But when we're talking about what happened, AA happened to me. And I got here, I was a complete non-believer. I tried AA. My first AA meeting, I was in ninth grade. I had to go if I wanted to get out of junior high school. And like I said, they laughed at me. And I took that as I had the expertise of the old timers that I was not an alcoholic. I know today that I am an alcoholic. I know today that people here have a lot more time, a lot more wisdom than I do, but all we have is right now. And by the time I say now, it's then. I look forward to next year. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but I'll be 30 years clean and sober. Don't clap. It hasn't happened yet. But I'm hoping that it does. If I don't drink and I don't die, I'm looking forward to that day. You know what I need to do? I need to make a commitment to all of you right here tonight that I need to start going to more meetings again. I need to go through my steps again. I need to be a part of this. Because if I don't have this, I got nothing. They'll take away my keys. They'll take away my life. They'll take away my serenity. There's a great word, serenity. I was never serene a day in my life. Even when I was a little kid before the first drink, I was always living in fear, which I didn't like to admit to myself that I was fearful, so I got angry. Anger is fear dressed up in a suit of armor for me. And I went around angry at everybody. I was angry at you. I was angry at the world. The world's not fair. And I mean, today, the world's still not fair. It's just not. But I can accept that. I have to accept everything as it is. Nothing happens by mistake. Nothing happens by accident. And if I can live in that kind of state of mind, I realize now that my serenity is in direct proportion to my expectations. My old man, when I was a kid, he'd always say, always expect the worst. That way, when something nice happens, you're pleasantly surprised, which is a hell of a way to go through life. Always expect the worst, because when something good happens, you'll be pleasantly surprised. I finally heard the actual statement that he was not phrasing it correctly. If you have no expectations, you can't be disappointed. So that makes a lot more sense. And it's a lot easier to go through life that way. If I have no expectations, I cannot be disappointed. I still get disappointed. I still have expectations. But I have to stop myself and pull myself up and say, hey, you remember what it said. And I, you know, this is a learning process. I have not graduated. I don't have this thing dialed in. I'm basically just one of you guys. And no matter how much time I got, I'm as screwed up as anybody. The newcomer walking through the door has as much on the ball here as I do. And I have to realize that. I'd like to think I'm graduating, but no, it never happens. And I don't want to see that happening, because then I get confident. Then I get complacent. Then I get arrogant. Then I get drunk. And I can't afford to do that. I mean, I won't survive. Like I say, I know I got one more drunk in me, but I don't think I got one more recovery. Because the last time when I got here, I was so sick. I could not lift my arms up. I had this alcohol hepatitis. When I went into the care unit, 29 years ago, my blood pressure was 150 over 120. My triglycerides were 1,670. My cholesterol was 600 and something. The doctor said, don't move, sit there. We made a mistake in the lab. We're going to take some more blood. And it came back the same. So they were worried I was going to stroke out, have a heart attack, or go into a grand mal seizure. So they made me stay in the med side. Usually it's 3 days. I was in there for 14 days. And then they released me into the general population. But I was so sick. And I know now that I can go back to that in a heartbeat. Once I take over and I move away from you guys, I get away from this program, the principles I have learned here, and my sponsor, and this lovely lady right here who's my wife. I met her at an AA meeting many years ago, 28 years ago. And she came in surrounded by a gaggle of women that were protecting her from guys like me. And then she proceeded to meet a guy who played drums in my band for about 10 years, and I knew this guy was a real mess, and I thought about telling her, but you can't tell anybody anything, right? So she had to get married, and for me, fortunately, this sounds terrible when I say it, fortunately for me, he died. And we got together. And it's the best thing that's happened to me in this program. Besides the sobriety part of it, my wife and I have been married for 47 years, just not to each other. And she is one of the gifts of this program. The same with my sponsor. My sponsor and I, he's when I first met him, I didn't like him because he spoke the truth. And I'm not comfortable with people who speak the truth without a bunch of bullshit around it. I'm sorry. It makes me really uneasy. But after hearing him several times, and I realized this guy has something that I want. So if you're new here and you don't have a sponsor, get one. If you're new here, read those pages, that first 100. How many pages in the book now? 163? Or did they change that too? Read it. When I first got here, my sponsor, not this guy, but another sponsor said, go home and read the first 164 pages 5 times. Well, 3 days later, I called him up, and he goes, what are you, stinking speed reader? He didn't use the word stinking. But I was a good speed reader. My comprehension was terrible. I couldn't remember it, but I could read really fast. I'm the Evelyn Woods School of Speed Reading, right? And whenever they asked me to read something at a meeting, I had to introduce myself as an alcoholic speed reader, because that's the truth. I can't retain anything, but I can read fast. That's not what it's about. Take as long as you need. I mean, sometimes I'd read a sentence and I'd have to stop and go back and read it 3 or 4 times before I finally understood what the heck they were talking about. Because it was like Latin to me. It was, once again, just this, you know, plus it's written in that language of the 30s, which I don't know if I've ever been in my cups. I've been in a lot of girls' cups, but that's another story altogether. The point I'm trying to make here is it takes what it takes. It takes as long as you need. There's no race. There's no timetable. If you're new, just keep doing what you're doing and come to meetings, meet people, shake hands, get phone numbers, and read that book and get yourself a sponsor. And after a while, it'll all start to make sense. That's the amazing thing about this. What was once just an alien language to me actually makes sense to me. And I couldn't do that when I got here. I could not stand still long enough. I couldn't stop talking long enough to listen. I have found after years of being around here, I never learn anything when I'm talking. I only learn when I'm listening. And I try to do more of that these days. My wife might disagree, but, you know, we're all doing what we can. How are we doing on time-wise here? Oh, we still got time. I'm going to speak another 15 minutes over time when I get here next time because you guys owe me. But anyway, what happened, what it's like, and what it's like now. What it's like now is I have a wonderful wife. I'm employed. I'm self-employed. I have an idiot for a boss and a flake for an employee. But you know what? I love what I do, and I do what I love, and I get reasonably well paid for it. And I have a car. I have a house. I have everything past my... If you'd told me 29 years ago what my life would be like today, I would have said, give me some of what you're on or get the hell away from me. Because I have a life today that I could have never dreamed possible. I had given up on myself, absolutely, totally given up. And I'm not that way today. I have hope. I can look to the future. I don't try to live in the future. I don't try to live in the past. I just try to keep my feet underneath me and just do the next indicated thing. And I still screw up. I've done a couple of boneheaded moves in the last few months that I'm so embarrassed and ashamed about, but I did them. And I have to own them. And I'm in the process now of coming to terms with all that. I actually started seeking outside help. I went to go see a therapist because, I mean, I may be sober. I'm, you know, all of these things, but I still have some work left to do. And I found a therapist that really resonates with me and really gives me the straight truth. And I'll give you just an example. I have a neighbor up the street who always constantly blocks the sidewalk. Okay? They park their car where I have to walk around their car. And then my wife in January had hip replacement, and she's on a walker, and we're trying to walk around the block every day so she can get, you know, ambulatory. And the car was blocking the sidewalk, and we had to walk around. She had to step off the sidewalk and down this driveway. And now what had irritated me before has now got me really pissed. So about a week later, I'm walking around this car again, and I had this ring, and I went on the trunk. It gets better. So about another week or two later, I'm walking around that car again, and this guy comes out of the house saying, why'd you scratch my daughter's car? He had one of those things on his doorknob, you know, that takes pictures, videos. And, of course, I played the trump card, just denied everything, because I still couldn't come to terms with the fact that I'd actually did it. I was so disappointed in myself, so embarrassed, that I actually, once again, impulse control, I lost it. And I've got to make amends to this guy. I know in my heart I've got to go up and give him $100, go get your car rubbed out or whatever it takes to get and make it right. Now, it gets better. I went walking around my car a couple of weeks later, and there's all these scratches down the back of my car, deep scratches. So I figured, well, this guy obviously scratched my car as payback. Well, I guess I'm free. I'm clean. I don't have to make an amends now because, you know, we're even. Come to find out, it wasn't the guy. It was my garage door. I didn't pull in far enough, and the garage door closed and went all the way down my car. So now I'm back to ground zero, and I had to go to my sponsor and say, now I got to go back and make an amends to this guy. Now, if that's not an example of an alcoholic who's out of control and not fully into recovery, I don't know what is. But you know what? I know what to do. I know I can see this through and make it right. And I am embarrassed. I did it at a group level because this I can't hide it. Secrets are my worst enemy. Secrets are what keep me sick and will get me drunk. If your darkest secret is a dangerous place to be. I still have some other secrets. I don't know. One today is, I think, enough. But I want you all to know that in my imperfection, I have some wisdom, I have some learning, and I have some faith, and I have some hope. And I still walk by that guy's car, and he still blocks the sidewalk, but I've been able to resist the temptation of going, one more time. I think about it, but that's the thing about AA. We're on the home stretch now. But I think about it, but I've learned in AA, just because I think it doesn't mean I have to act on it. I'm going to get 5 minutes? Wait a minute. Okay, that's about all I got, except I wanted to say thank you for having me. I'll be back to this meeting because you're a good group. Good night. Thank you.